This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
No team has changed more from last season than the Seattle Seahawks. I firmly believe that. Seattle, and it sounds weird because they've been such a successful team. They're 5-0, the last unbeaten team in the NFC. But I don't think any team has changed the way they play more than Seattle has so far. Going from a team that would survive by the skin of its teeth with fast and furious comebacks to being a team that has built early leads and actually who's entered the fourth quarter in strong position, strong likelihood of winning in each of their five games.
They've done it successfully. There have been some other teams that we've seen make dramatic changes, like New England now has Cam Newton under center, so they're trying to adapt to that. But to successfully make that change, it's difficult, especially during a year where you had limited time to prepare.
That's a case of personnel, though, right?
Yes.
Like, that's a case of personnel changing.
And that happens every year for every team.
Seattle hasn't changed personnel on offense. It gets really, I mean, they've added a couple guys.
Offensive line, to an extent. Yeah.
But that, they've changed the way they play. They've changed what they're doing and the way that they're approaching things in a way that I didn't think was likely. I certainly knew it was possible, but I didn't think it was likely. And I think it needs to be acknowledged that Seattle is winning even more than they did a year ago. But Seattle's off to a great start last year. What, they were 4-1 to begin with?
Mm-hmm.
They're off to a great start while doing it in taking an entirely different route. They trailed at halftime in 10 games last season. They came back and won six of them. They're not playing from behind this year. Of those five games, there's only one that they were trailing at halftime. It's been a remarkable adjustment in the way they play.
And you would think that continued success would maybe make the adjustment continue to adjust, if that makes sense. That they will be reinforced that their ideas that they have changed this offseason since they're successful are things that they should maybe do more.
Well, it certainly has reinforced it. It certainly has reinforced and seeing the reward for that emphasis. My biggest question is whether they can keep playing at this pace on offense.
It's going to be really hard. They're scoring at an 89% clip in the red zone. That is beyond historic. And while there are a lot of other teams in the NFL right now that are also having success in the red zone, that is 10% more than every single team's red zone offense going back to 2003. And Danny, that's as far back as I could go. So it stands to reason it goes even further back than that.
That when you see a team that is succeeding at such a higher clip than anything that we've seen, usually that's a flashing red light saying that this probably is going to come back. This, you're probably not going to be able to sustain at this level if no other team over the past 17 years has been able to do it at that clip. Doesn't mean that you won't be near the top, but to be that far out in front of what anybody's sustained through a full season and you're only five games in, I don't think they're going to keep putting with this efficiency.
Probably not. I mean, you're stuffing the 07 Patriots offense and the 2013 Broncos offense in a locker right now. You have the most touchdowns in the NFL and you've only played five games. You've attempted two field goals, which is also just a striking number. And that was, though, something that the Seahawks didn't do a whole lot of the first 5 weeks last year. I believe they only had five field goal attempts in the first five games of the year, and I think they ended the season with 26, 28 field goal attempts. And maybe as the year goes along and the weather changes, that could be something that comes back, that could be a factor. But there's also the element, Danny, of since there are other teams having this kind of success, this just might be the one year where defenses are so comparatively incapacitated that this can continue.
That question of whether we think defenses will catch up. I do think they're calling more holding. I think we're going to see some of the offensive numbers start to come down, and I'm not sure how much of that's going to be due to opposing defenses being better and maybe a little bit of a different shift in officiating. I holding was up over this past week, but that question of whether the defenses adjust, I think is a really good one. You would expect in most seasons that abbreviated practice time would result in worse offensive performance.
Yes.
That it would affect the offense more than it would the defense. Because the defense's job is to run around and wreck stuff. And, like, yes, practice helps and it's important, but ultimately you can make up for a lot by just hitting people so hard that they fall down on defense. That is always a fail-safe approach. Yet, so far, we've seen that it's been the offenses that have been firing and scoring at a historic clip.
Yeah, and what a development, what change, other than what you mentioned, Danny, an increase in holding calls, what is going to all of a sudden allow defenses to catch up? Like, I actually don't see it coming. I've been thinking long and hard, and where is it coming from? Are teams all of a sudden going to develop a 12th defender? And it's been such an anomaly this year. It's as if there's been some major rule change. It can't be just holdings. And that you said just a second ago, the cliche or trope that we always say about the NFL, the defense is always ahead of the offense early on in the year. Well, if it's not now, like, when is it going to be? I don't think it's coming. I think the offenses are going to get crisper and crisper in these games where there's no crowds.
I do think that no crowds is playing an effect. Like, even with what I think it was 9 of 14 games this past weekend were played in front of fans, they're not full. There is not the same difficulty of pre-snap adjustments that there has been. Typically, even in bad stadiums, it's loud enough that makes it. Quarterbacks, it's such a huge advantage to have a quarterback. I do think penalties plays a role. Defensive pass interference is up, holding is down. Both of those things are going to be dispersed scoring. I don't particularly like that you can game the system that way, that the powers that be in the NFL get together and say, okay, we don't want low scoring slogs. How do we keep that? How do we keep the game from being ugly? It's like, well, stop calling holding and call more defensive pass interference. But I think that's pretty clearly what has happened. I do think that things tend to correct themselves over the course of the season. I think we will start to see more holding penalties called.
Well, that would be a bummer because I don't think there's any team that changes like that would benefit more than the Seahawks. Pass interference is, you are the team that throws the football down the field the most, and you have you have one guy in DK Metcalf who is always going to have to be interfered with when you're throwing it that far. You also have an offensive line that's young, featuring Damian Lewis at right guard, that has a lot of new players that haven't played a whole lot, Ethan Posick at center, Brandon Shell at right tackle, Mike Iupati, Dwayne Brown, not the guys that they were maybe a couple of years ago. So it adds up really well for Seattle, and I hope to an extent that while the football maybe hasn't been great outside of Seattle as far as just the increase in defensive penalties and the decrease in holds, I hope the system continues to be gamed for Seattle because, again, maybe these ridiculous numbers can keep up.
The other thing is you look around the NFC and every team is flawed. Like, there's and the flaws are not tough to pick out or to find. That Seattle, even if you think they can't continue scoring at this pace, there's not any team that jumps out at you as saying, hey, that's a notch above, or that's a team that they have to run and catch, or I don't know if they have the talent to compete with that team. Seattle is at this spot despite playing without really three safeties. They lost Marquise Blair for the season. Delano Hill has been out for the past three games, and there's no sign that he's anywhere close. In fact, it sounds worse as opposed to being more positive given what Pete Carroll had to say. And then Jamal Adams has missed the past two games, and we don't know if he's going to be back to play this week. So despite all of that, they're undefeated. And that is a concentration of injuries at what we've talked about as being a critically important position for Seattle's defense over the year. Throw in the fact that Quandre Diggs missed the second half of a game, right? He missed the final three quarters of a game against the New England Patriots, and Seattle's still undefeated despite that loss of personnel. That's really – and there was everything that I saw this weekend – everything watching in Seattle's bye week told me that there's no team to beat in the NFC other than Seattle. Like, Seattle is clear. If you're ranking somebody ahead of them, I'd like to have a conversation about how exactly you arrived to that point.
Yeah, I was looking at a tweet about MVP probabilities, and, you know, you take a look in the AFC. Okay, I don't know who the one seed is going to be. Kansas City is probably the odds-on favorite, but Pittsburgh has been really impressive this year, and Tennessee continues to just – break my brain by being way more successful than they should be with Ryan Tannehill under center. But if you take a look at the NFC, who really has a good chance at outdoing Seattle for the one seed? And I'm taking a look at this five-game stretch ahead, Danny. They should go 4-1 over it. And I know that that might be asking a lot. You're playing the division four times over that stretch, and you're playing Buffalo. All those teams
and
are competent.
Buffalo.
Right. Like they're all competent teams, and most of those games are on the road. But I'm looking at each and every single one of those, and I'm wondering, okay, can the Cardinals, with their, honestly, I think, pretty mediocre offensive performance against Dallas on Monday, can they keep pace with you scoring-wise? Can San Francisco do the same thing? Can Los Angeles? All of those teams are having issues. And now all of a sudden you're seeing Josh Allen and that Bills offense come back to earth a little bit. I feel like you can outscore all of these teams. And even with your defensive issues, I think 4-1 is possible. And that the one seed, you got the inside track, assuming that Green Bay can't pull out of this tailspin. And that was a big tailspin that they took.
It's such a funny season, man, because you look at their previous five games and you're like, what's their best win? Record-wise,
yes.
It's over Miami.
Miami, right. It's crazy.
who just changed starting quarterbacks at things. And that's an unfair characterization. I think Miami's played better than a lot of people have expected.
They're tough.
They're 3-3. But these next five games, it is kind of the widowmaker turn, right? You've got a
yes.
couple games against Arizona in there. You've got a game against San Francisco and the Rams. Plus, you go on the road to play Jared Allen or Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills. That game doesn't look as difficult. Certainly, this would be the stretch where Seattle needs to find its stride, and you want to see some progress on defense, even if and for the offense, you're hoping it just maintains some of the momentum, probably realizing that it's not going to stay as effective in red zone scoring as it's been.
The offense is in stride, you know, and
yes.
if your strength is already in stride, you would think that someone's going to ultimately, on the defensive side, catch up. The real question, again, is who? And it's going to be big for them to get Jamal Adams back and to get some of these other players that have been banged up back as well. I don't know if Daryl Taylor is realistic, but Snacks Harrison would be a help too.
He would. Are you worried about Kyler Murray? I am.
I am worried about his mobility. I've gone from calling him Kyler Kitty Cat Murray because I feel like now that's a little demeaning too. The Catman! He is so fast and
he's
quick.
He's really quick. He's really quick.
He was 9 of 24 against Dallas, who stinks. So
it's 3 for 12 passing to start that game. 9 of his first 12 passes fell incomplete, including two deep shots that either he misread it or Isabella misread it, because there were two times that they should have had touchdowns that he was just flat out off.
Eight targets to DeAndre Hopkins, two completions. And while he did have the two big receptions, 140 of his yards essentially came on two plays, and he had less than 200 yards passing. So I am scared
of
Murray's feet.
He dominated that game. I mean, you watched it play, like, even though he's not, and maybe that's just how bad he is, I find myself very, very worried about what he might do against Seattle's defense.
I got a question. Go back to the Seahawks-Cardinals game. That was the first game that we watched together.
Yes.
Right here at the 710 ESPN Seattle Studios, right before we did our first show. And I remember Kyler in that game, the mobility was scary.
Yes.
Nothing else was. Has he really taken a step forward since then as a quarterback, as a throwing-the-football quarterback? Because I don't think he's taken much of one, while I still respect the heck out of his talent.
I do think that he has gotten better at passing. I don't think he's an entirely different player. I think he knows how to use his weapons better. I think he is the X factor in this.
Yes.
It is Danny and Gallant, and it's time for us to go around the NFL.
It's time to go around the NFL. Brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. The bottom line on the biggest stories in the NFL every morning at 9:15 with Danny and Gallant.
Today's an exceptional day.
DJ. How's it going, guys?
Good. How are you?
Doing good. Welcome back, Danny.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
You say it like it was just so bad with me, huh? No response either there.
No.
Just awkward laugh.
Paul. Well, first up, the Saints have been given the go-ahead to have at least 3,000 fans at their home games. Sorry, up to 3,000 fans at their home games. That number can increase to 6,000 for November if COVID-19 cases remain stable and 15,000 for December.
How many of those will be Seahawk fans?
Ooh, good question.
I imagine there have to have been some people that have found ways to buy it, but you also have a pandemic. There's travel restrictions. I don't know if the Cardinals are refusing purchases from certain zip codes, which I know teams have the ability to do when it comes to online purchases. This Cardinals team is actually good. I'm curious. Generally, Danny, has that not been a little bit of a mini road trip for Seahawks fans every single time?
The time that the Seahawks fans emerged as a national presence, the emergence of the 12th man nationally was a Thursday night game in Arizona. And people stayed and chanted behind the NFL Network telecast as it was going up. It has been extremely loud. Pete Carroll said he heard it in Miami. They had
fans
down in Florida. Yeah. It is. Seattle is the closest thing you see to college football traveling groups. Other teams like Dallas, Green Bay, Pittsburgh, you'll see a lot of fans, but usually those are people,
they live there.
With national fan bases. Seattle will travel. I think you'll hear it. I think you'll hear some of it.
When asked about the players' discontent within the Cowboys' locker room, head coach Mike McCarthy had this to say.
I've always stated this to every team that I've coached. I think it's important to handle things as men. I mean, if you do have something to say publicly that is of most importance, I think it's important to say it to the individual, particularly in a group dynamic setting, and especially in the game of football, especially for the Dallas Cowboys. I mean, that's all part of the development of our program, of the system that we're installing here.
You can talk like a man!
Easy to say, man. When you get people and players start questioning coaches like that, it usually means that there's something that the players don't trust what they're being asked to do. And I think that this is about defense. I don't think it has anything to do with their offense.
We heard from Richard Sherman a couple of weeks ago. They're doing too much. And if you're doing too much, then it's going to be confusing for a lot of these defensive players. But I will say, the offense has to have a whoa, what are we doing right now kind of feeling. They are too talented for that effort that we saw on Monday night. Like, maybe Arizona's
Andy Dalton, what are you going to do?
He can't be that bad, right?
He was terrible.
He was so bad. Like, I was surprised by how bad he was. I'm not the biggest Andy Dalton fan, but you would think he's one of the best backup quarterbacks in the league, and they have a lot of talent around him. Ezekiel Elliott fumbles twice. I know their offensive line has some issues right now, but man, there's something going on, and maybe there is a lack of faith in the coaching staff. I know Ed Werder had brought up the point, though, that maybe this is on the players. The players are the consistent holdover from the Jason Garrett era. Whatever the case, there needs to be more communication between Mike McCarthy and this team, and it feels like there's zero, and that's sad.
It's hilarious. It's not sad. This is the team that thinks it's brassy enough to call itself America's team. It struts around. It is covered as if it is U.S. Standard Oil with the importance to national security that it has. They're missing what? Both their offensive tackles are out. Lael Collins and Tyron Smith. They've undergone surgery. Zach Martin got did he suffer a concussion? He left with a head injury for a little while. They've got a rookie center who got hurt, Joe Looney. It's hilarious. This is awesome.
And they can't really fire him either, right? Like Mike McCarthy.
Yes, they have more money than God.
That's a lot of money.
Didn't they make a mistake, though, in not going after a sexy coaching hire? This is just as boring as it gets. You got portly Jason Garrett.
Yeah, I agree with that. They went and got a guy that they thought would be a CEO. The weird thing is that he is a head coach who's not running his system on offense, and he doesn't really have that much to do with defense.
And he's not aggressive. We saw in the NFC Championship game.
Yeah, they brought in a figurehead kind of coach, a guy who's supposed to arrange everybody and stand up there and be the politician.
Saints head coach Sean Payton says Michael Thomas's discipline is already over and he's eligible to return this Sunday.
Still wild, man. He got still wild that he ended up getting suspended for a fight in practice. That it really makes me wonder what Michael Thomas has been like behind the scenes.
Yeah.
That is something, because nobody knew this happened until he was suspended. So that means that there was an issue within the team about either how he'd been acting or what he did.
Who has a blow up next? Is it Odell Beckham Jr. again, who was upset on the sidelines against the Steelers on Sunday, or is it Michael Thomas getting mad at Drew Brees and his noodle arm?
I think it's Brees. I think it's Michael Thomas and Brees. That's what I think it is. I don't think Odell Beckham Jr.'s. I don't think he's.
You know,
because he was just being demonstrative. What he wasn't. It wasn't a get me the ball sort of fit, wasn't it? It wasn't like let's play harder.
I don't know.
What did you think?
I think he's angry at his quarterback. Because Baker Mayfield, look, I like Baker too. We both like Baker. We are a Baker-friendly show. That was a bad game for him, and I know that he was banged up, but he said afterwards he was feeling better than he had been after the game before that, where he rocked his ribs against Indianapolis. I think it was described best. I think it was Mike Sando talking with Ryan Russillo. He feels pressure after getting hit a couple of times that isn't there. And that's something that's a little concerning for a quarterback that is, I think, known for mobility and being able to move around. If he's feeling pressure that isn't there and he's moving when he doesn't need to, that's concerning.
He got clobbered in the game before. Like, you could tell he was banged up going into this game.
Yes.
I wish I was the sort of person who would have decided to take action on things, because I would have predicted that they got housed because their quarterback wasn't healthy. You're just going to let me get away with that? I basically just said I knew this was happening even though I didn't say it.
Well,
you're going to let that fly? You're going to let me get away with that kind of ridiculous?
I don't think ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Well, actually, I thought this was going to happen.
I mean, but didn't everybody in the world think that the Browns were going to get housed by the Steelers? Yes. And we didn't want to say it. We were all hopeful. So yeah, absolutely you get away with that.
It was like that moment where you're like, oh, so you think you're a contender, huh?
Yeah.
Smush.
Poor Cleveland.
No, not poor Cleveland.
Why not poor Cleveland?
The world needs a butt of a joke.
I agree with that. I like it when it's Clayton Kershaw. Wasn't that last night? Poor Brownies.
That is around the NFL, our weekly or daily tour to see everything that happens. There is a bright side to Seattle's defense. You just have to look hard to find it. We'll tell you what it is next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Seattle's run defense, better than average. It's pass defense, a problem. I think we've all thoroughly settled on and hashed over it, even after a game against the Minnesota Vikings, where they didn't allow the same degree of passing yardage. Instead, they got battered on the ground. I don't think any of us feels too great about this secondary, but I'm going to try real hard to give you a silver lining here, Paul.
Okay, let's do it.
I'm going to try extremely hard, because after watching the Denver Broncos lay waste to the New England Patriots, I found myself wondering about, I thought Cam Newton looked really good.
Wait, this sounds worse. This is making the Seahawks defense sound worse.
It did, because that's what I looked at. I was like, man, this is the guy that completed 75% of his passes and threw for almost 400 yards.
Chucking bombs to Edelman.
Oh,
it's been a husk.
Yeah, the whole thing. I was like, how did this offense give Seattle so much problems? What exactly? And so I went and looked up, and I went with the full expectation of finding out that every quarterback Seattle played, Matt Ryan, Dak Prescott, Cam Newton, Ryan Fitzpatrick, Kirk Cousins, had their best game of the year against the Seattle Seahawks. That they looked, they were world beaters in that game, and they've been awful the rest of it. And what I found, I would consider surprising, because yes, Cam Newton had by far his best game of the season against the Seahawks, but the other four, pretty much about what they've done in other games in terms of passer rating, in terms of touchdowns, interceptions. Completion percentage was a little higher. They got picked off more. But the other four teams, in fact, Matt Ryan, Fitzpatrick, and Dak Prescott had a lower passer rating against Seattle than they had on average in their other games. That they didn't. Quarterbacks have not exactly come in and just torn apart the Seahawks. Does that make you feel better?
Slightly. Question mark? But let's try to figure out why that is, and maybe we can feel better together, because that's where I'm at right now. Is it possible that certain styles of quarterbacks this Seahawks defense is going to be better at? Because what I think about is, okay, Cam Newton is the anomaly performance. Newton is the most mobile and the most unique of all of those quarterbacks. Fitzpatrick can move, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, Fitzpatrick runs around a little bit, but he's older now.
And it's a different style of running. Like, they're not calling designed runs for Ryan Fitzpatrick either, though he might want those.
Would you say that Fitzpatrick's style of running is chicken with head cut off?
Yes.
like Cam's part of the designed run play. Fitzpatrick is chicken with head cut off run play.
If you could build an offense that's entirely based off of an endless gif of Gus Frerotte smashing his head against the wall with the Washington football team back in the day, that would be the Ryan Fitzpatrick running the football experience. It's just a painful, painful watch, but he can scoot a little bit. So maybe it's that. Maybe it's that when Seattle's going up against offenses that have a quarterback that can move in unique ways, that's where things start to break down for them. Dak can move too, and Dak played exceptionally well in that game. It wasn't really, though, the scrambling that you might have expected from Dak a couple of years ago. It was mostly him just chucking the football down the field. So does that bode well for Kyler Murray on Sunday, or is Murray totally different than Cam Newton?
He runs differently than Newton. Newton is more of a downhill runner, right? Like, he's elusive, but he sees a path, and then he's faster than you think, given how big he is, and he can take a hit or two. He's not going to go down with one tackler. If you have him matched up against a DB, good luck. Like, Cam's going to run over that player. Murray is someone who is just, he's able to make something out of nothing. And his speed and the way he changes things, I do find myself worried about him.
I'm not. I should be, probably. Because if you don't have Jamal Adams in this game, what's your second level going to look like trying to track him down? KJ's been awesome this year, but this is a guy who is uniquely quick. He moves around the same way that a really skilled person playing Pac-Man at an arcade plays. Like, he moves back and forth, and it's almost as if he can take square turns. And that speed that he has too when he gets into the open field is also alarming. And he can definitely run away from a lot of the guys that the Seahawks have in the front level of their defense. Though that one time where Rasheem Green sacked him last year,
that was impressive.
That was awesome.
In these games, the most important thing is contain, right? The most important thing is having guys stay in their rush lanes and not all of a sudden collapse down because they think they can get a sack. Because if you miss in that, if you're the outside pressure and you vacate that, and he evades you, then he's got space. The most important thing for you to do when you face, and this is what Russell Wilson was such a handful for teams for so long, is because when he would spin out the back, all of a sudden he's got the whole field and you don't know what he's going to do. The most important thing for Seattle in this game, I don't think necessarily is the speed of their linebackers as much as it is the discipline that their pass rushers will have to maintain the edge of the rush lane that they have.
Yeah, and the guys that you have out on the edge, that means Benson Mayowa, right? Is that a game where you play Alton Robinson a little bit more? Robinson's been pretty good, I think, in terms of discipline on the edge, as far as you would expect a fifth-round rookie to be.
Yeah, I want to see more of Robinson, period. I don't really care about the situation or the game. Like, I want to see him play more because
I thought that
he's flashed the couple of times that they put him in there, and hopefully he starts to build some confidence from that.
Yeah, and I imagine not playing would be hurting the confidence. I know you don't play a guy just so that he gets his confidence up, because that would mean that you would be putting Trey Flowers out there all the time and like, okay, Trey, build your confidence in this game. But yeah, it's been weird that he has not played that much, and Who would he take the snaps away from? I mean, I think we've been relatively satisfied with a lot of the performances of defensive linemen, even though the pass rush has been relatively non-existent this year.
This is a game that's important for LJ Collier. Mm. And I've thought that he's had a really good game, good season so far,
too,
and taken some significant steps forward. One of the things that we've always, or the type of player he is not a fast twitch edge rusher. He's not somebody that's going to come roaring off the edge, but he is a tough guy who is someone who is going to sort of steel-toed, stand in the trenches, hold his lane. He is able and has had success getting penetration on the outside. That's exactly what you need in this game, is that slow, steady pass rush that's able to contract the pocket around Murray, as opposed to someone who is going to flash in and just come roaring around the edge. The worst thing in this game would be to miss a sack and let Kyler Murray start running in space on the outside.
Yeah, I'm with you. That would be definitely concerning. But I think I'm more concerned about the running backs for Arizona. Remember the first game last year between the Cardinals and the Seahawks? Chase Edmonds, who was finally getting some snaps instead of David Johnson, he was pretty good in that game. And then, of course, you saw Kenyon Drake against the Seahawks last time around. And Kenyon Drake finally busted off a big run, which we had not seen him do to this point of the year, against Dallas on Monday night. And that also goes back to the same guy, LJ Collier. You can't let this team get to the second level with any of the runners. And that's going to be hard for them, the Seahawks, to do.
You also see that Arizona is a team that likes to take shots deep. And maybe that is different from what Cliff Kingsbury's offense looked like last year. They've really tried to get opportunities to throw the ball downfield. To Isabella was a guy that had gotten open twice. They've got another speedy wide receiver. And then clearly DeAndre Hopkins is a huge point of emphasis for their offense.
Do you think that the days of staying on top are here to stay? Do you think that was just that game against Dallas was just an absolute disaster anomaly that resulted in a wake-up call going forward? I think it has been, actually. I feel pretty good about the Seahawks' ability to stay on top going forward, assuming no more ejections of Quandre Diggs.
I want to see it in a game where they blitz a lot. I want to see it in a game where Seattle gets back and decides to blitz, and maybe they're going to stay away from that. Maybe that's not going to be part of their plan going forward, and they determine that, hey, taking those chances early on, that's what left us exposed on the backside. But I want to see them in a game where they call and blitz with the frequency that they did those first 3 weeks before I announce that I feel confident that they've got it all fixed there.
Yeah, but maybe they don't. And you said it just a second ago. I almost think that the odds of them going back to super blitz heavy outside of just using Jamal Adams in that role, I almost wonder if you want to even think about going back to that, because it's something that they have not done in the past. It's something that they tried to do a little bit earlier this year and clearly failed.
It is Danny and Gallant. We're going to raise our flags. That's coming up next.
From the pocket and flags everywhere.
Flag on the play.
Now there's a flag down.
Every morning at 9:45 with Danny and Gallant. Brought to you by Carter Volkswagen.
If the noise persists, the defense will be charged with a timeout.
Flag on the play.
It is Danny and Gallant. Like we do at the end of each show, we try to put a little bow on things. Offer some sort of parting shot. Admonishment. Praise. I think I'd like to go first because I thoroughly enjoy Al Michaels. I think that he's my favorite person to listen to during a game, and it's not just the rapport that he has with Collinsworth, which I think is really good. It's that he sometimes will let you know that he's had enough, where he's just fed up. But it's done in a way that's not like Joe Buck. Because at Joe Buck, there are times where I feel like he's angry to be doing what
he is. Disgusting act.
Right. Like, there's a moment where I'm like, okay, ramp it down. Like, your job is to narrate this game for me. But for some reason, when Al does it, it's like a little bit different. Where it's not like he's angry to be there. He just wishes some of the malarkey people would knock it off. This is the end of the first half. San Francisco 49ers and the Los Angeles Rams. And my wife and I, when we were listening to it, we both just cracked up because there's a penalty called for defensive pass interference, and Al had just had enough.
I don't know about that, Coleman. Whatever. Or Shania Twain would say, whatever.
I like the dated Shania Twain reference,
whatever.
Too.
I don't know about that. Whatever. Just, it was, I don't know why it like hits me as pitch perfect, but it was just like, yeah, that's exactly how I felt. It doesn't make any difference. It wasn't going to get him, put him in scoring position. It was a waste of everyone's time over a ticky-tack penalty. Whatever. I love Al.
By the way, when did Whatever You Do Don't by Shania Twain come out? Like, the early 90s?
Yeah. It's Al, man. He's timeless. That dude is the soundtrack, and I think I will always... He was there at the Earthquake game of the World Series.
That's incredible.
31 years ago. Like, his longevity and the important things that he's been there for. People don't talk about him in the same way that they do some of the other guys. Like, I don't enjoy Costas at all. I always feel like I'm being lectured by Costas. I love Al Michaels.
I enjoy Al Michaels as well. I should not hate on anybody having dated references either, because despite being 31 years old, my references are generally quite dated. I'm just surprised that Shania Twain is something that came to his mind. That album came out in 1997. Good job, Al Michaels. That was cool. That made me think long and hard about myself. Yeah, whatever.
DJ, what do you got?
I'm throwing a flag on ex-Astros general manager Jeff Luna. Now, yesterday, he said this about the Astros cheating in 2017-2018.
The reality is the Astros cheated in 2017 and cheated a little bit again in 2018 using just the decoder method, and it was wrong.
So he admits to a little bit of cheating that they did. He's still denying his role in the sign-stealing scandal. I'm sorry, he knew that this whole thing was going on. They're all complicit. I hate that he keeps denying this. It's the Carlos Correa thing all over again. It's just, you're guilty. You're guilty. You knew what was going on.
I think what he's guilty of in this interview is of something that Danny is not a fan of, which is saying that, yeah, but these guys have not been punished. And he talked about one person that he had personally demoted that was a part of the cheating scandal that has since been promoted back up in the Astros organization. So clearly, to the Astros, that guy's involvement or alleged involvement wasn't that big of a deal. But part of me also wonders if he's actually being honest and accurate by saying those things, or if he is just painting a possible scapegoat so that while he tries to sort of explain his role away in this interview, there is actually someone to pin it on.
There's no way to look at what happened in the totality of the Astros organization and come away with the feeling that Jeff Luna was a good executive. Like, incredible at talent acquisition. But between the way his deputy behaved over the addition of Osuna, the way he acted after that junior executive was basically taunting female reporters, the entire thing reeks of him being a bad leader. And when you come out and then try to minimize your involvement, that further falls into the category of bad leader. Like, I don't want to... That doesn't make me more interested in hiring you. He's a really smart dude who probably has a difficult time relating to people and was not ready to be in an executive leadership role. And coming out and saying that, yeah, but other people were worse, but you ignore the things that I did do, it's a terrible PR strategy.
Yeah, it's not working. But what can he do? I mean, what can any of these guys do as far as a PR strategy, you know? This is, I think, the only thing that you can really do to publicly make things seem a little bit less terrible.
Incorrect. Here's what you do. You know what? The things that we did were unacceptable. Those things will never happen again under my watch. I've learned from the mistakes that were made and the things that I overlooked and the ways in which I know I can be better the next time. That's how you do it. It's that easy. I was wrong. I've thought about all of the different ways that I failed in this regard, and I think I'll be a better leader with my next opportunity. And instead, it's like, well, you didn't really get the fine. You want to explain that you're bad, but not that bad. You want to explain that you're wrong, but you weren't that wrong. Stop!
I'm with you. You are the apology doctorate here.
No, there's no... If you say it was my fault, and I will do everything in my power to make sure that I never do anything like that again, there are no follow-up questions. You might not get the job, and it might take some more time, but there's no of this picking it... You know, I was wrong. Paul, your flag.
Really quickly, breaking news, the Seahawks signed Michael Kendricks to their practice squad. That from Adam Schefter about 2 minutes ago. So you'll hear more about that from John Clayton, the professor. I want to raise a flag to Gary Payton. Gary Payton wants to return to coaching in the NBA. He told this to Yahoo Sports. Danny, you covered this man. I am just so excited about the idea of somebody who trash talks like this being in the world of coaching.
You're going to be my cheerleader! That's what you gonna be, my cheerleader. Boy, you ain't talking about nothing. You don't know. You ain't nothing. Boy, all you do is run around and be a suck on everybody else. Sucker. You a sucker.
Gary Payton. Mike Brissett.
Keep laying wood on his ass. Keep laying wood on your ass. Keep laying wood on your ass, man. You weak. Weak ass. Get your weak out of here.
That's Gary Payton as a coach. That's not Gary Payton playing basketball. That is Gary Payton as a coach.
That would be funny, man. The glove is eminently enjoyable to listen to. I'd listen to him read a phone book. It'd be entertaining. That's great.
Do you think that would work with all the diva personalities that basketball has? A guy that is that in your face? Because there really doesn't seem to be a coach that's quite like that, that also has that kind of I dominated comparatively as a basketball player. Like Jason Kidd's probably the best player coach that we have seen in the game over the last couple of years. I don't know about as a coach, but like best player that we've seen coach recently.
Yes. And Jason was always more understated as a player.
Yeah.
He was never confrontational. It would work if Gary was different in private. It would work if Gary, that was his public persona, and then in private he was different. From what I know and what I've seen, and maybe Gary's different now, the Gary Payton I knew as a player would not be able to coach because he wouldn't reach enough guys. He would be a great coach for two or three players. And I think that the other players would have a lot of players that were better elsewhere than they were playing for him. Doesn't mean I wouldn't want to watch it.
I would kill to watch that.
Also, this quote from Mary Kay Cabot. Odell Beckham Jr. doesn't think COVID-19 is, quote, going to enter this body. It's a mutual respect, end quote. Okay.
I like that quote.
Yeah. Wear masks and have mutual respect.
Yeah. Yeah. The virus doesn't. The virus respects you.
That's going to do it for us. I want to thank John Clayton for joining us. Then Michael Bumpus, who was with us in the 8 o'clock hour. He is Paul Gallant, DJ, keeping us both on the rails. And Paul, don't get him anywhere near gingerbread Oreos.
Oh, yeah, I'll eat them all, and I'll puke. That happened yesterday. And he is Danny O'Neill, and he is a man living in a cabin down by Vermont. So long, farewell. You'll hear us tomorrow.